Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your favorite spirit lover and haunted house native, Mikala Ann. On this week's episode, we have guest Sasha Ravitch, professional folk necromancer and astrologer for witches. Sasha joins us this week to discuss the importance of folklore and mythos as a foundational aspect of cognitive blending between birth chart and scrying mirror. How does one's relationship with the dead affect the living? In what ways can we explore myth and fairy tale to inform our understanding of liminal relationships? Why should people cultivate caution when developing spirit sight? And why is it so important to extend one's practice past the personal and into a more communal perspective? All this and more with one of my mentors and dear friends. If you find this podcast interesting and want to show some support, consider checking out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/saturnvox. I can also be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Saturnvox.
Hi, as Mikala mentioned, I am Sasha Ravitch. I am a traditional or folkloric witch, professional astrologer, and spirit worker who specializes in the aliveness of the nativity, that is the natal chart, and the cathexis or the occupation of spirits within it and the ancestral inheritance of the native. All of my work is really influenced by folklore, by fairy tale, by the mythopoetic nature of human storytelling, and more importantly, the story spirits tell about us. I mean, in general, the nexus of my work is kind of formulated over a lot of different layers and dropping in subsequently to each layer over time. But there's like a really, like, I guess, practical way that the fairy tale folkloric narrative influences my work, and then there's a more metaphorical way. The practical way is that I literally sit with every person's chart before I go into any kind of session and essentially imagine what kind of tropes, what sort of story, what sort of narrative arc, fairy tales always have an allegory, right? Folk tales always have like some sort of moral or ethical theme throughout them, some sort of parable that is told. There's some journey, some heroic journey that's told, and a myriad of different characters that interplay. And I actually sit and I think about the stars and the planets as these characters. I think about the native as this protagonist, and I look to find the TLDR, right? This like too long didn't read. What's the one line that surmises this story, right? So that's the more practical applied way that this influences my work. And then on a more, I guess, sort of metaphorical or semiotic level, I'm consistently working with the sweeping grandeur of whether it's narratological interest or whether it is this deep and sort of cathartic experience of enchantment that we all seek in the day-to-day, and the blurring and the blending of lines that sometimes feel really rigid in waking life and in our more or shared consensus, you know, mundane reality. But within the scrying mirror, within this sort of fairy pool of the natal chart, we are able to blur some of those boundaries, and they become access points to understanding greater journeys in fate or destination or special inheritances or, you know, significant missions that really characterize the way value and moral and personality is built, and kind of the court of spirits that inform, support, or even work against that.
Wow, that's amazing. So what you're saying is you're basically using fairy tales and myths as like the set container
and then applying semiotics like cognitive blending to fuse the story. So like maybe some sort of fiction narrative with the fact or the absolute of the fixed placements in a birth chart.
Totally. Yeah, that's a really, that's a much more eloquent and intelligent way of putting what I sort of waxed poetic about. But yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I was personally really inspired by the way in which some of the earlier psychoanalysts would use fiction, narrative, story, especially the folkloric tales of their countries as devices in which to understand human experience, right? And I think that that becomes animated in a really profound and, quite frankly, much more actionable way when you know that spirits exist, when you know that they are capable of being engaged with and interacted with. And so what was once metaphor, what was once a way of trying to figuratively explain this elusive thing that can't be pinpointed or can't exactly, you know, the simulacra, right? Like this thing that you're trying to address, but you can't get to the thing of the matter. You can actually get to the thing of the matter when you believe in the reality of the spirits that haunt whatever tale it is, right? This isn't just fiction. We're working with fact. But because we have this restrictive consciousness, and because we've been so programmed to think in terms of reality versus fiction, right? We often have to break our own fourth wall in order to engage with the liminal, in order to engage with the spirit world. We have to be able to dissolve that boundary. And that is something that I believe situating ourselves within the fairy tale framework allows for us to do a lot more easily.
Oh, I love that. So for the magician, then, there is an added benefit of helping the practitioner kind of break down the modern perspective that, you know, there's already plenty of theories in semiotics and, you know, just like Lakoff for one and metaphors we live by, that the way that we structure our mind is based around the myths that we tell ourselves. So of course, like the psychoanalysts then of times past would use fairy tales that they grew up with, because within the structure of their environment, those are the myths that inform the entire social cognition. But you're suggesting that it goes beyond that, because the magician, through viewing these fairy tales as maybe practical advice for how to deal with spirits, gives them the ability to move past the modern conception that this is all just psychological and happening in our head.
Totally. And I have often tried to argue that these stories are points of entry into other worlds, right? And even when you, I mean, it's so interesting when you think about this in contrast to the fact that in many, many folk tales and many fairy tales, there is the idea, I mean, whether it's the Book of Lost Things, whether it's the Chronicles of Narnia, right? There's this idea of like the protagonist existing in reality and then having to physically enter into another world, right? There is a threshold that needs to be crossed. And I think we get sort of like meta about it and we create that layer that through utilizing or applying, or rather being able to ascertain which folkloric or fairy tale arcs are occurring within our own natal chart, I mean, that is the point of entry into our own Neverland at a certain point. Through that blurring, through that blending, it is us. It's an access point. It's a incredible stamp of our soul, you know? It's a map. And if we can navigate that map, we can understand more fully the really incredible power that the natal chart serves as an alive thing and as a world, right? Not just a blueprint or an imprint that has to do with our personality, which is so much of what we've seen in contemporary astrological discourse, where, you know, a very ego-centered universe wants to focus on telling me more about myself. And obviously that's really cool. And we all want that. We all are gratified from cultivating deeper awareness and understanding of the nuances of our personal selves. But when we look at the natal chart as a world unto itself, right? Our world, our spiritual world, what our fairy tale world looks like. It's like a hack to entering there, you know? You tear a hole in the dimension.
Yeah, so you're suggesting that the natal chart works not only as a scrying mirror, but a literal mirror portal that one can then step through to maybe, because, like, you know, the liminal is always there, but we are each predisposed to being able to access it through certain portals that we can examine in the birth chart and then kind of step through, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So do you then feel like, for example, if the fairy tale itself is the portal, would we, you know, like, let's say there's a specific mythos that you have associated with a certain planet in a certain house. Would you say that fairy tale, like read it out loud as kind of an invocation in order to pass through the portal? Or what is the method that the practitioner would use once they pinpoint which stories are accessible to them?
Okay, that's a really great question. And I've never been asked that before. So I'm really like considering, and I'm like going over what seems to, which planets or stars seem to tip me off immediately to the terrain that we're going to be navigating. And I mean, it'll come as no surprise if anyone listening to this is familiar with my work, that there's one planet in particular, the planet I always look to first. And then there's two other planets that are majorly supplemental in this work. And these three planets in particular are the planets I find write the majority of the story, though that's not to say the others don't play significant roles. But they are, for me, perhaps because of these being the planets that are the most influential in my chart, these are the entryways. And it's always in order of operation: Saturn, the Moon, and then Venus. And I think that's because Saturn is my entryway into working with everyone's ancestors, which is a key part of this fairy tale. And I can go into a little bit of like specifically what that usually looks like, because it's a huge, huge role in the endeavor of my spirit work that allows me to make contact with people's dead. And then the Moon for me creates the portrait of the landscape. And I understand immediately when I fall into someone's lunar placement, that includes the decan, the nakshatra, the stars that are in parans or by conjunction, the sign, the dignity, the house, of course, the topoi, right? All of these things factor into that, and they create the world. The Moon builds the world, the sensorial and physical experience. Saturn shows me where and how the dead are. I always encounter them in the sense of people's ancestors being in a building. Saturn shows me what that building is. And I can tell based on what, if it's a house, at a bar, is it a prison? What's the nature of the house? What does it look like from the outside? Who is in what room? And in what does whatever room the spirits are tell me about their condition and how they feel? And how are they dressed? What is the mood? What is the energy? Saturn gives me all of that. And Venus tells me the most important spirits that are walking with an individual in this fairy tale, who is going to be their primary, especially the stars in parans or conjunction with Venus, and the house for Venus will tell me the nature a lot of times of the particular type of spirit, the appearance, the aesthetic, the feeling, etc. And those all supplemented by spirit sight and obviously the contractual nature of, you know, my spirits working in agreement with someone else's opens all those things up for me. But those are the main three planets. And then of course, you know that, I spend a significant amount of time focusing on what I call the haunted houses. So the 2nd, 4th, 6th, 8th, and 12th. And I'm spending additional time specifically researching the 9th house at this point as one of those haunted houses as well, especially depending on particular planets there and what they represent for the person as far as their spirits.
Okay, so instead of it being more like an invocation, we can look to Saturn and we can know, like, this is where I've come from. These are the narratives and the stories of the people before me that inform the work I'm going to do now.
Yeah.
Then the moon is basically like what the landscape or the environment, like the liminal portal that we step through and what it looks like on the other side.
Totally.
And then Venus is who's there, who's there to work with us. So we're not reading a fairy tale and invoking anything so much as when I look at these three planets, I can know which kind of spirits might be more susceptible to working with me and under what conditions and in which environment.
Yes, and also no. So we're working with those to paint the portrait, right? But then my personal narrative style, I play the role of Mercury in these readings. So I look to someone's natal Mercury placement, for instance, and that informs me how I'm going to communicate this story and share it. And I have particular readings that are actually expressed and conveyed to my clients through a storytelling lens, right? Like I am telling their story through it. And those are a particular series of readings I do. But as far as a, like an intentional invocation, I usually do that privately first. And I open up in the presence of a series of spirits that I do this work specifically with, where I allow them to come through me and to say aloud or share aloud what this truth, this sort of synthesis statement, right? This concluding chapter. And then, you know, it's interesting because when you look at a lot of traditional folklore, it's in that concluding statement and that concluding paragraph, we actually understand most often what, like, the beginning was meant to symbolize. It gets away from it through it. So I always look to sort of the end. What is the ending statement? What do we end on? And that opens up for me everything I need to say in the session.
Okay. So your pact with your spirits is to allow you to open up as a channel so that the client spirits can speak through you.
Yes.
I love that. So it's a combination of using semiotics and like this analytical, very air thing of dissecting things down into which containers in the astrological delineations. But I think what makes a skilled diviner is that added bonus of having the spirits actually channel through you and be able to say, I can pinpoint which of the things within that container this is referring to.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel in many ways that a gifted diviner, whether it is tarot, whether it is geomancy, whether it's astrology, whatever particular, whether it's I Ching, right? There requires the act of shapeshifting. We don't travel to these worlds of spirit, these worlds of in-between in our own corporeal form, right? And it's really necessary that we have, sometimes it's not conscious for everyone, right? But I know consciously for me, it is through my capacity to engage in essentially a spirit flight or a shape-shifting that allows me to enter into these worlds through the benefits, the gifts, and the honors of my own spirits to communicate with someone else's. And that is what I think a diviner is capable of doing, right? Is being able to go to where the spirits are to communicate with them.
Oh, love that. So there's this liminal activity where you are tangibly seeing these things, or do you find that the words just come out of your mouth freely?
You know, it's interesting because it's both, right? I would have said in earlier developmental and skill building times of my life, it was much more of like the sort of oracular came out, right? A lot of that has to do with my heliacal star and a lot of the other stars that play a really significant role in my life, where there's sort of they're stars that are linked specifically to more prophetic speech, right? But it is really been my emphasis and my inclination over the past about year and a half, 2 years, to cultivate a deeper spirit sight, which allows me to tangibly see and interact with. And I've actually been struggling a little bit because oftentimes more vivid and visionary experiences take longer to extrapolate or communicate through language, right? Like, the more I find myself engaging in the world of spirit, the more problematized language becomes. And trying to shift between the gears of communicating in an eloquent, comprehensible, intelligent way, while also allowing myself to revel in the visual and apparent experience of seeing these spirits, it makes it hard. It's hard to communicate. So I'll times I'll find myself sort of tripping over my language a little bit, or having to let clients know that if I get a little quiet, it's because I'm trying to allow myself to see and then communicate. My goal is ultimately to get to a point where I can do both simultaneously, seamlessly, right? But that's the work of a lifetime, maybe, for me. Who knows? It's flipping between those senses, which have taught me a lot about this Lacanian idea, right? That language is actually a prison, and it is not integral nor natural to much of the spirit world, and is actually this sort of hindrance that we as corporeal human beings really get hung up on. I've been learning a lot of that through the more visionary and more ecstatic nature of seeing spirits, that it's communicating through language is not necessarily the default, right? And that brings up a lot of really interesting issues when people want to communicate with spirits and they really mostly know how to use words.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why most divination systems use, you know, symbols to convey multiple layers of different meanings within one symbol, because the universe does speak better that way, it seems. In what ways have you had to kind of, what have you done to practice maybe blending those two things, because that really is kind of the great work of any channeler.
It's practice. That's I don't think there's anything I could do other than doing it. I mean, I'm sure there is, right? I do not know anything. I know barely anything in the great scream of this work. What a Freudian slip right there.
I think that's very accurate.
But I found that I'm a stickler for consent, right? So there are a lot of ways in which I think that if I were constantly practicing this on people, even like in my off time or whatever, I would be able to become much, I guess, I would be cultivating the skill of being able to do both simultaneously much quicker. That being said, I really won't ever do it unless I have already had permission. And it works a lot better when the person is present for me, and is also intentionally aware of opening up and allowing these things in, right? I won't scry someone's spirits without consent. And I won't even like peer deeply into the chart or even really look at their natal chart without their consent. Those are big for me. And I think that means that the majority of my experience that I cultivate in these two skills are live, right? Like, they aren't me getting to like practice a whole lot. And I mean, I'll work on scrying certain locations or places, right? But as far as this type of very intimate, very vulnerable, very like soul-bearing work, it happens in the process. And I have noticed that the cultivation and the ease with which it comes is certainly necessitated by the frequency in which I do it. I'm doing it approximately 3 to 5 hours every weekday, you know? So, I mean, that's certainly, you know, if I'm doing this in particular, these types of readings, usually at least 3 times a day. So at least 3 hours a day, every weekday, Monday through Friday, I'm clocking in a lot of hours of practice a week. So that's what I would say it is. It's the practice, because the trust comes from the validation happening over and over again, of someone confirming over and over again, of you receiving those emails of people confirming the things you said over and over again. And that is, that's the biggest thing for someone like me who needs the validation outside of myself to feel secure in offering a thing. I wouldn't offer it if that weren't the case.
Oh, I love how this kind of pinpoints, though, we are, especially me as a air moon, I am always like, what can I do to practice this skill? Like, what tangible thing can I do? And it sounds like what you're saying is just opening yourself up to it, feeling more comfortable, feeling more confident, especially because it was kind of predetermined in your birth chart. It just naturally started to flow, or it flows more naturally the more confident you feel. Totally.
Yeah, it's a real bummer that we, and this isn't to say this is the case for everyone, right? There are people out there that see spirits as if they are physical flesh and blood people right in front of them. That 100% exists for certain people. I'm glad it's not me. I would be scared shitless literally every day of my life. I still remember being a child watching The Sixth Sense and being like, nope, can't do it. No, sir, right? This is my literal nightmare. I'm scarred for life. The way in which I think the majority of people who see spirits, is in a visionary capacity, is through the projected lens of the imaginal, right? But also trusting that that doesn't mean fiction. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's absolutely bullshit. Probably, like, at least half the time is absolutely bullshit. But, like, when you have gone to an extent where you, you know, I have, like, a certain candle I always have lit, I have a certain materia that's always used, etc. And I'm working deliberately, right? This is the virtue of spirit works. I'm working deliberately with particular spirits who are going to make sure what comes through is true and accurate. They're not going to let me get caught up in my own BS. And that is such a great ease for the sense of confidence, because a lot of times, I mean, people are like, why do you keep your camera off while you're doing this? And I'm like, well, because I look fucking goofy, you know? I'm staring off into the distance with my mouth open and my eyes crossed, you know? Like, that's not, it worked for the Oracle of Delphi. She had a thing over her most of the time, you know? But it's like not an attractive look when you're on a Zoom webcam and the person, you know, looks like they're about to pass out drunk, right?
You're just going to have to start veiling.
Oh my God, yeah. You want to see me as like a bobbing silken specter? Sure.
I do think people would want to see that, actually.
I know, I would have to change my voice, though, so that I'm like, on the 4th of July, and then 7:15 p.m., a dark man will descend from the hills, you know, make it a whole thing.
I would pay for that. Okay, so what I'm hearing, though, is that there is some sort of checks and balances that you have. And I think that's important to discuss, because there are going to be, even for people who believe that these spirits exist, instances in which we or maybe other people in our lives may claim to be interacting with something and it's not what it says it is, or maybe you're not even really talking to anything at all.
Totally.
And do you have any advice for people on just maybe how to set up checks and balances so that when they are engaged in work with spirits, that they have a point of validation?
Yes. Okay. So I have multiple, because I am very fastidious about this. So first and foremost, I believe there should always be some sort of personal practitioner right? Like, the space needs to be cleared first and foremost of any intermediary or interceding spirits that might just be fucking wandering through, that hopefully you have something in place in your environment that you would be reading in general to protect this, so that you don't have to do it every single time, but it's still useful. And then I always recommend too that you have some sort of invocation in particular connected to your spirit that helps the most in this work, right? Maybe there are some people that do it without the support of spirits. I can't imagine doing half of what I do without the gift and blessing and benefit and resources that the spirits who work with me and that I work with and for help me and support me with. So that's a thing that I recommend. I recommend having a divination system separate from the one you are using in order to, and in particular, I find this works really good with tangible sort of yes, no things. I use coins, for instance, for this. I've consecrated coins specifically for the primary spirit. And they are consecrated to that spirit. I know that when I use them, that is who I'm talking to. There's no one else coming through or around or with. And that allows me to get a yes or no. And then I also have mentors and teachers slash godparents that I go to that are also, like, especially with a big thing. I mean, obviously I don't do this with every client I have, because usually the client is in the session being like, holy shit, I've seen that spirit. Or, oh my God, that sounds exactly like my great-grandmother. You know, like those sort of things that let you know you're on the right path. But if it's big personal stuff that's going on, right, and this is a huge issue, I often don't think that we are always the best qualified as the final audience on our own stuff, right? And so that's when I go to my mentors in witchcraft, my teachers for the particular fairy scene tradition I'm in, and for my elders in the other traditions I'm in as well, to confirm objectively. And I know that all of them will tell me if I'm full of shit, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that last one is really poignant. Like, as a reader who does spirit sight readings myself, I don't like to do them for myself. I don't even like to read for myself.
Totally.
Like, even mundane questions.
Yeah, it's very challenging. I mean, like, there's an awareness we need to have with our own biases, right? I still remember being, like, 14, and I would be pulling tarot cards, and I would start to turn one over, and it'd be a card I wouldn't want, so I would, like, be like, oh, that one doesn't count. And I would, like, put it aside, right? Like, I already know who I am. Or I'd want a card so badly I'd pull it, and then I'd spend the whole time thinking that it was, like, my own will that was so powerful, right? That it directed me to this card. There's no need to put yourself through additional stress or second-guessing or, you know, kind of gaslighting yourself around your own gnosis. And for some of us, you know, especially if someone's got a lot of error in their chart, it might just be easier to be like, can I get a second opinion? If we do it with health conditions, there's no reason why we can't do it with spiritual conditions.
Oh yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I will consistently be like, oh, I manifested this card because it's the one I want. That's definitely me. I don't trust the good ones. Okay, so when there are actually a couple of questions that I have that came up. I mentioned, and you've mentioned, that when, you know, let's say Venus is close to certain parents or certain fixed stars, that can, you know, be an indication of having, like, certain types of psychism, you know, the clairs, if you will. And I guess I want to know what your take is on fate, in that if you do not have any indicators of, you know, being a clair, is it still something that you could learn with time and dedication? Or is this something you think needs to be identified in the chart?
I have, I think, a controversial opinion around this, but I'm willing to put it out there. I'm being frisky, I'm being spicy. One, I think there are certain things that are strictly hereditary, and that is not a popular or conventional opinion. There are certain, and when I say certain things that are hereditary, it doesn't mean that any of the psychic senses are strictly hereditary. I think certain lineages, certain roles, that are especially, like, culturally bound witchcraft-related things, or certain omens, those for me are hereditary, right? Like, not anyone could pick up and be something that is a lineage-bound thing. Now, I think literally anyone could fucking see spirits. I think anyone, I mean, and I think people are going to be predisposed or stronger, I guess, in certain senses, right? Whether it's hearing, seeing, sensing, whatever, right? But I think that anyone can cultivate those skills. I don't think that anything is inherently special about having any of them. One of my elders always brings up, you know, that there's like nothing special about being able to see spirits. A lot of people can do it. Most of the time, people don't know it, right? And going back to that thing again where we kind of dismiss things as imaginal.
Mm-hmm.
Without realizing that, you know, imaginal is not synonymous, is not a synonym for fictitious or unreal.
Love that.
And there isn't anything particularly special about, you know, it's gonna come easier. But I think, again, a lot of it has to do with the amount of practice, the amount of spirits you're working with, the balance and harmony as far as right relationship with those spirits. And more importantly, is your life going to benefit from it, or is it going to get worse, right? I think that that's a thing that we don't see talked about as much, but is really important in a culture where spiritual emergence and emergency often get conflated with mental health crises, too.
Oh, yeah.
At the end of the day, if someone is happy and wants to work their life not as in a role of spiritual service to the community, there might not be a major need for them to have to hear or see spirits. In fact, it might actually make their life much more difficult. They might find themselves losing quality of life over those tools. There's no need for them if they aren't going to improve or enhance your life, right? I think that when you are working in a capacity where you are of a spiritual mentor or coach or working in a healing position as a spirit worker, etc., then it's more useful. Like, in fact, perhaps pretty mandatory that you be able to have some of those skills, because it isn't the person that heals in a spiritual capacity. It's a spirit who is doing the healing, right? So you kind of need to be able to see or communicate with those. And those, in my experience, tend to be connected to traditions or lineages, etc. Doesn't mean that someone who has those gifts can't do it independently. It's just harder because you're not going to be receiving the same level of training. You're not going to have elders to sit at the feet of and learn from. And all those things just make it a lot more difficult to do alone. And again, sometimes lead to a lesser quality of life. I think the main reason why my enhancement or recent cultivation more deeply in a lot of these skills has improved my life is because I have mentors, because I have community, because I have elders, right? I have context. I have people that are going to hold me and ground me. I have people that are going to help me refine different skills. So I think that anyone can learn these things. I think you have to be honest with yourself about whether or not it is going to make your life better and if you want that additional responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the importance of elders, the importance of community, but I also like that you pointed out that some people may not be disposed to handle the interactions of certain spirits as well as others. Like, if you have a really, you know, an open or an empty, if you will, eighth house, you may not be as disposed to working with spirits of the dead as somebody who has, you know, Venus in the eighth. They're just off the top of my head, you know, that maybe you shouldn't work with the dead if you don't have some kind of strength in your chart that shows that you can deal with the insanities of restless dead.
Absolutely. And, you know, here's the thing, though, is even in that way, we have crisis points, right? So you could have a luminary, you know, I'm a person with a luminary in the eighth house. I have a domicile luminary in the eighth house. And obviously, I do a lot of work with intranquil or trickster or ancestral spirits. And a lot of the spirits in particular that we have contracts with coming into this lifetime, right? Because that's a big part of the eighth house. But depending on certain dignities, I mean, like, because I had other things going for me, that worked out as a supportive mechanism. But I'll tell you, like, the majority of my life having a luminary in the eighth house felt like it caused me a lot more harm than good, right? I think that there are things that are natural supports. I look at it more as being oriented toward a thing, whether something will come naturally for you or easily. That doesn't always mean comfortably or happily, right? For instance, there's no one that is better off spending a lot of time with Restless Dead, right? There are people that can do it, but they usually have some sort of supportive alternative spiritual liaison going on too that is containing or protecting. And that's a really important distinction, is that what is safeguarding you? What planet maybe is an access point for you, a portal for you, and what else is going to pull you back out of it?
I see. So even just having the domicile luminary in the eighth didn't necessarily mean that you would automatically be, you know, susceptible to this in a positive way, though it did indicate that the door was open. Yeah. There's other things in your chart that support and safeguard what is happening when you are interacting with the Restless Dead, that make it so that you are more able to interact with them and not, you know, be negatively affected.
Totally. I mean, the eighth house for me is a cave in which all the bones of the forgotten dead or the less benefic spirits get tossed, right? And if you're going to go spelunking in this accursed cave, right? It's really important that there are planets holding the ropes above that are going to pull you back out. One can't live in the eighth house.
Well, they could, but they probably wouldn't be happy.
They shouldn't. Like, what kind of life would it be? You know, if you're only amongst the dead and the unquiet, is it really living? One can get lost in the eighth. One can float there. One can exist there. But it isn't really, I guess, living in the extent of thriving.
So it isn't even so much about what you are predisposed to or where your own personal strengths and weaknesses lie, so much as, like, which spirits and you know, what do your ancestors have to offer already that you can hold on to as you go do the work?
Yeah, or more importantly, do you have your other luminary in a very visible house, like the 10th or 11th, where it's going to be able to be externalized and visible enough that you have a light to return back to, right? That you can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's the land above. You know, if your other luminary is, say, in the fourth house or the 12th house, that's going to be, you know, like, a little more difficult. Okay, where do I resource? Where do I find a tether that brings me back home? Because there's a lot we can do to romanticize living in the other world and running away to it. But I ultimately feel that at the end of the day, if you are working toward a position of spiritual service, it is your responsibility to be present among the living. It is your responsibility, and in fact, your obligation to be servicing those that are still existing here. Otherwise, it's not the role of a healer, right? It's not the role of someone who's trying to support, or at least it's not the role of someone who's trying to heal living people and their lineages. It's someone, if you want to work specifically with healing spirits or the dead, you know, go live in the cave.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is do you feel like, you know, that the ability to see and communicate more directly with spirits implies the responsibility of becoming a healer?
No. I don't think so. I don't think I feel comfortable telling anyone that they are responsible for doing this work.
Sure.
I feel like as we see in a lot of Siberian shamanistic stuff, that there's a major health crisis or spiritual or like psychological crisis that can happen as a result of avoiding doing that work if you are specifically being told you must do that work. But if you are someone that, for instance, has a 9-to-5 tech job and like can also just hear spirits, but you have no interest in changing your venture, I mean, I would stay at the other job, quite personally, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely more security and stability. The
yeah, and then you don't have to deal with, like, occultists. So it's all the more better, right? just kidding. Love y'all.
Look, there are bros in any scene.
Totally. So I guess I also just don't feel comfortable telling anyone what they have to do or what they should do. Because I think that if you don't want to do it, that doesn't mean that you won't end up having to do it. But if you don't have to do it, there's no reason why you should. You know, there are other people that will fill that role. And if you have to do it, you won't be allowed to not do it, as far as I'm concerned. It'll be the only thing you can do, so.
Yeah, you'll get physically ill if you try to do anything else.
Totally.
That actually... Okay, so... Kind of segueing away a little bit, though still on topic, I guess. I'm wondering in like, what other ways does this idea of fairy tale... I'm kind of thinking, like... When we use the word mythology, we kind of feel like there is a more theurgical aspect to that. Like, people used myths in theurgical practice, you know, for pretty much more of time in that occult has been around than, you know, post-Renaissance Western occultism has been around. But fairy tales, you know, that has always seemed like a different category of narrative. And you are kind of suggesting, let's like bring, you know, you recently posted on Patreon a working that had to do with the three blind mice, you know? And so I'm just wondering, in what other ways does fairy tale come and inform your practice outside of just the nativity stuff?
Well, I found that when I am in it's actually really like funny to me because I have a background in poetry as like a published poet. It was one of my focuses in undergrad, etc. And I always hated rhyming in poetry. And I realized recently one of the things that's happened is when I am calling upon particular spirits to write the operations, the workings, the rites, etc. that are offered through my Patreon. They come in this, like, really not my voice at all. Like, very, you know my voice. You know my voice when I'm being poetic or when I'm starting to sound good. Like, the things that are coming out are specifically these, like, very fairy tale, rhymy sort of situations that I come about and I was like, wow, I hate how this rhymes. But I spent so much time in my formative years in more ritual, ceremonial, magical environments. And it's not to poo-poo those at all. But it isn't authentic to where I come alive and what feels sincere to the way magic works for me. For that, that's all thonic, terrestrial, folk magic, witchcraft stuff. And what we don't see a lot of now, but used to be, especially in Babylonian, Mesopotamian, and Egyptian stuff, was a lot more witchcraft related to what would be more appropriately called astrology. This idea of working with constellations of stars, with the planets, in a place of devotion, worship, magical relationship, apprenticeship, noumenal expression, as opposed to a operant conjuration where there is this sort of requisite harnessing or kidnapping of the planet. Now, I'm not one of those people that's like anti-conjuration or kidnapping or like talismanic stuff at all. I don't have that. That's not part of my moral ethic. I state very clearly that my definition of a witch is someone who's become increasingly monstrous and inhuman over time due to their relationship with the more than human world. I have a very traditional, like, witchfinder general self-identification of witchcraft. And so I make no pleasantries about any of it, right? But the idea of folk astronomy or astrology and the tales told about the constellations and the stars and the planets in a actionable way that made sense for especially rural people that had thonic rites and initiations that were bound to the terrestrial earth, right? Or even the subterrestrial. These things are lacking from a lot of the contemporary astrological, magical, and theurgical conversation, where we default to a lot of stuff that has just such a overarching Golden Dawn, Rosicrucian, etc. kind of vibe to it. And my goal is to bring us back to the dirt, right? To bring us back to blood and dirt and hissing and screaming and laughing and crying.
More of this.
Yes. And this ecstatic and embodied and possessory nature of astrological magic and these spirits as they appear on Earth and in our relationships, and not just as angels captured in your like carnelian, but as tutelary guides and as initiatrixes and as challengers and opponents, right? That problematize and re-enchant what it means to be a human, like to be a spirit that's stuck in a corporeal body, right? But we're all still spirits. It's very natural to work with the spirit world. We are also spirits. We're just, you know, like fleshy trapped ones for the time being. And what does it mean to not see that body as a trap? And, you know, I'm someone that has historically struggled a lot with having to have a body, you know? And what witchcraft has allowed me in my astrological practice is to find within my body each star that I have a relationship with, each planet that I have a relationship with, how they feel, how I feel when I am communicating with them, when I am receiving from them, when I am petitioning them. How do I resource all of these out there things in the in there of the self, and create a sort of a unity and a home on Earth for the celestial to come and occupy?
Oh, this is so touching, because it's like what you're talking about is astrology and magic, not just for the self, but for the union of myself with all the rest of the beings that may be, you know, touching me and interacting with me. And how can I honor both myself and the community of ecology and spirits within every thing that I do and everywhere totally. That I go.
I mean, that's what right relationship ultimately is about. And also removing the narcissistic or the ego factor from this, or like at least a lower ego factor around like what the stars, what the planets, what the spirits can do for me, as opposed to how can I be of service to them. There's nothing that like Sasha can do, right? It's like what I make myself open for spirits to do through me that is ultimately going to be helpful to people. Like I just like want to watch my, you know, reality television and eat peanuts. Like that's Sasha's work, right? But for this period of time, every day I can open myself up in this way for spirits that are capable of doing more than eating peanuts and watching reality television to work through me. And that's how I see myself in that service role. It's not to diminish that I'm like a real person who does cool things and does nice things or whatever, but I'm relatively insignificant within the continuum of how long a star has been alive.
Yeah, you're like allowing yourself to be an instrument of the spirit's work. And in that way, you know, maybe you yourself didn't wake up one day and say, I think I want to be a healer. But when the spirits started channeling through you and you're like, okay, I literally have no choice but to do this work for 5 hours a day so that they will leave me alone and that I can just sit down and watch my reality TV when it's over.
Totally. And, you know, I'm like, I'm always in the process of trying to teach or train people, because I don't think, again, that this is something special about me. I know that I, as far as I know, I'm the only person doing this the way I'm doing it. And I would like other people to do it too, so that there are more, there's more people that can do this thing, you know, because it is a lot of work. It's not work that I can do probably forever, right? And I think that it is work that is not meant for, like, I'm not special. I'm not like the one person who's meant to do this thing. And so I think that when we consider ourselves as, like you said, an instrument in a beautiful orchestra of many other instruments that are all doing really incredible things and creating really, masterful instrumentation in their own right, then we all cultivate a really important melody, and that's part of that Song of the Universe.
Yeah, I mean, you're writing a book on this. So, I mean, ideally, after the book is published, there will be other people who learn, you know, from your insights and then kind of become pupils of your method, right?
Yeah, and I actually have had quite a few people express interest in apprenticing under the particular way in which I do things. So I'll likely, probably not until fall or early 2023, be doing a small cohort of folks that are already trained. Like, for me, it's mandatory. I wouldn't take someone in from get, you know, I need them to have a traditional or Hellenistic background, because those are the techniques I use to build things upon. And ultimately, the lens I use, the tools I work, are not a substitution for having a good foundational Hellenistic or traditional astrological understanding, knowledge. They are supplementary. They are in relationship to, they are supportive of, but they are not a replacement for, right? I'm definitely, I do weird stuff. So sometimes people think that I'm one of those people that's like, whatever comes to you. And that's not true. Anyone who actually really knows me is that I'm kind of like a real stickler for tradition and kind of an asshole for UPG or things that seem to go outside of what I know, you know, like to a fault. Like, I recognize that about myself. Again, very Saturn 9 person. So we're kind of like, what do you mean? You just were going to do a thing this way. It's supposed to be done this way. So
Saturn plus air sign. Yeah.
So I'm consistently sort of having to challenge myself in that own belief system, since I keep being a thing I didn't want to do or be, which is kind of outside of the box. So
yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. You know, it's how can you teach an entire method of scrying, divination, and astrology 101 at the same time? That's kind of beyond expectation, yeah. But there's already so much astrology 101.
There is.
Like, we don't need a new person doing astrology 101. No. What we need is innovation in astrology now that we've done the work of kind of unpacking what was lost through the Hellenistic tradition. It's kind of coming to be that time where astrology is now producing new things.
Absolutely. And we're in a really exciting climate right now that I feel really thrilled to be a part of in the astrological community, where a lot of my peers are doing really cool and special work. I mean, we got Amaya Rourke doing some really incredible stuff around gardening in particular, and she's amazing with star stuff. And then you've got Oscar Diaz as well, doing really, really cool stuff as far as his creative, artistic, poetic background and his integration with the Islamicate medieval astrological stuff, the way he's incorporating and subsuming all of that into his work. And Palace Augustine doing some, I think they're about to release a whole little book just on the IC and this idea of coming back home and right relationship and connection. So there's a lot of really interesting and innovative work that's being done, a lot of deepening, a lot of real settling into like the muck and the lichen and the filth and the beauty of what has been set up but has not yet been plumed by astrologers. And I'm really excited to be part of a community that takes seriously the past and tradition and the structure and the rules, but desires to illuminate and elucidate ever more.
Yeah, you heard it here first, guys. Make sure that you learn the foundations of astrology now so you can take advantage of all of this supplementary stuff coming out in the near future.
Do it.
Well, all right, my friend. This was such a lovely conversation, and I feel like I learned so much. I usually ask my guests if they want to leave the audience with anything before we part, like last words.
Yes. Spirit work, divination are not a substitute for therapy. spiritual coaching and mentoring is not a substitute for therapy. You can't do this work well. And honestly, if you are not in right relationship with yourself, it won't be sustainable. It won't ultimately be useful for supporting yourself or others. If you have trauma and you do this work and you don't have some sort of, I mean, full disclosure, I've been in therapy since I was 13, right? Like, there's no shame in that. But if you have myriad complex issues of intersectional trauma throughout your life, it's really, really important that you allow yourself your own framework for support and healing. Don't try and help others before you help yourself. You'll sink.
Oh, love that. We could do a whole episode just on that.
That's our part two.
Yeah, exactly. Next season.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, and before we go, you gotta plug the book. Tell us a little bit more about the book you leave.
So I'm gonna be doing a lot more writing on it this summer. It's been a very busy spring so far. I wasn't expecting it to be quite as busy as it was. I have a book forthcoming through Revelor Press, edited by one of my mentors and one of the most badass astrologers out there, Jen Zart, Dr. Jen Zart. And it is a exploration essentially of the way in which the nativity is haunted. We do everything from my particular system I innovated around significations for the houses based on like thousands of charts that I've gone over. We look at different classes of spirits associated with certain lunar signs. We look at different stars as access points to the more than human in relationship via, you know, birthborn packs. Etc. All these different situations. It's sort of if you are a witch and you're an astrologer, it's gonna be, I think, a useful resource to add to your compendium. And in it, I'll go into a lot of this stuff regarding folkloric or fairy tale related rites, a lot of the astrology and folk astronomy, but also hopefully give some pretty useful techniques for you to employ in your journey or venture toward endeavoring in this work. It's called Restless Dead, Restless Living, tentatively, so far.
Well, I, for one, have been patiently waiting, and I will keep patiently waiting, and then I will devour it as soon as it is in print form.
I know. I timed it for a level one peak period, hopefully. So we'll see.
That's
I'm trying
so funny.
To get there in time.
Zodiacal releasing, go.
Yeah, I'm trying. ADHD.
I believe in you. If it's meant to happen, then it'll happen.
Yeah, totally. But the contract is signed, so it's happening. It's just, I'm getting there, man. I'm getting there.
Pressure's on. Yeah. Pressure's on. All right. Well, I love you dearly. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about all this. Besides just loving you as a friend, I respect you immensely as a practitioner and as a teacher. And it was just so great to finally get you on here.
It's a real pleasure. I am honored to be here amongst a cadre of really cool special practitioners that are all really integral and foundational in their own ways. And I'm excited to see all the incredible things that you contribute to this world.
Thank you. You too. And I love you, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah. See you this weekend, probably.